Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on the complicated international landscape the president now confronts. President Trump is in Florida today, where he's hosting the president of China. Trump has tweeted that he anticipates a very difficult meeting, particularly because trade and North Korea will be on the agenda. But even as the president focuses on China, his administration is trying to figure out how to respond to the chemical gas attack in Syria, in which dozens of people died. Witnesses reported seeing children writhing and gasping for breath as they perished. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley referred to Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, as a war criminal and said this: Russia uses the same false narrative to deflect attention from their allies in Damascus. How many more children have to die before Russia cares? President Trump said the chemical attack, quote, crossed a lot of lines for me.
That attack on children yesterday had a big impact on me. Big impact. That was a horrible, horrible thing. And I've been watching it and seeing it, and it doesn't get any worse than that.
So that's part of what we're going to cover this morning. I welcome your input and your questions. If you have questions about U.S. policy with Syria, Russia, China, and Korea, you have an opportunity to call in or tweet in and ask them. How do you think President Trump's early handling of international issues has gone so far? So we welcome your questions on international policy, and I'm also asking you to reflect for a moment on how you think President Trump's early handling of international issues has gone so far in his administration. 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. David Kang is one of our guests. He's a professor of international relations and business at USC and the author of, among other books, China Rising. And he's with us today from L.A., where I know it's a little early, David. Thank you very much for coming in early to talk to us.
My pleasure. It's always fun.
Steve Sestanovich is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the new book, Maximalist: America in the World from Truman to Obama. And he is with us today from Washington, I assume. Steve, welcome. Yes, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks very much.
David, President Trump said yesterday in that press conference where he talked about Syria, quote, "The world is a mess. It's a mess. I inherited a mess." And when I heard that, I thought, well, doesn't every president inherit pressing and pretty urgent international issues from his predecessor? Is there anything unique about what's going on right now?
Well, sadly, there isn't. I mean, you know, every president comes in, the world has always had enormous numbers of problems. And every new president gets tested, especially because we're the United States, by all the countries around who have issues, North Korea, China. And so Trump is facing what all typical presidents face.
Do you think that's what's happening with North Korea and with Syria? And understanding that we're going to dig in deeper on that. But overall, are we seeing testing happening here of the Trump administration?
Absolutely. And the launch of the North Korean missiles just a couple days ago, China pushing for this early summit, which in many ways I don't think the United States is fully prepared for. We haven't really, the new administration hasn't really figured out its own strategy towards China and Asia. This is all pushing of the administration. At the same time, what Trump has done is laid down a bunch of arguments about what he will do. And so he's testing other countries for how they'll react as well.
Steve, what's the purpose of that testing? Is it so these countries will know what they're dealing with for the next 4 years or something more?
Well, sometimes it's to take advantage of disarray in a new administration, to gain an advantage where other countries think the United States may not push back. But it's important, I think, to distinguish among different cases. The Chinese have put some pressure on the U.S., kind of put down some lines of policy to try to see whether the United States would agree to them. And on that issue, Trump has stated a pretty clear orientation. North Korea is a case where it's clear that testing is going on. But the administration hasn't had a particularly clear view and is only trying to put together a strategy. And then in the case of Syria this week, you know, the administration actually has had almost no policy. They focused on ISIS, not very much on the Syrian civil war, and they're really scrambling to try to figure out how to respond to this latest atrocity.
And Steve, I think we got a sense of that in the press conference yesterday. The president said that Syria is now his responsibility and that the chemical attack, quote, changed a lot of things. Well, what does that mean, do you think?
Well, a professor of mine in graduate school used to say that that's the sort of thing that a president says when he doesn't have any idea what he's going to do. And in this case, I think it's obvious that the president is responding to global outrage, very intense media coverage of this event, you know, dozens of people killed by chemical agents, and he's trying to get ahead of the game, but improvising. The fact that he said it crossed a number of lines already increased the responsibility that he has for it, because people will want to know, well, if they've crossed lines, then what are you going to do about it?
Right.
So far, there's been no indication as to what the U.S. is going to do about it. And some other countries are actually challenging him on this. You know, the Russian foreign ministry press spokesman just said today, well, okay, what's your plan?
Call for you here, David, from Judy in Edina. Judy, what are you thinking about?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call. I am very curious that in all of the media analysis that I've heard in the last few days, I haven't heard anyone connect Trump's recent statements about leaving Assad in power and letting him have his way because, hey, there's nothing we can do about it, and the fact that then within a week Assad is dropping chemical weapons and committing atrocities. Isn't there a connection there?
Yeah, David, is that part of the testing that you were talking about a minute ago?
Well, I think in some ways it probably is. I think in general, the problem that Trump is facing is that he's come in with essentially a very minimalist foreign policy. He's talked a lot about not getting involved in things that don't directly affect the United States. And he's already being pulled into these issues. And we're seeing now how that essential foreign policy orientation is being challenged again, not directly by Assad, but certainly now he's claiming much more responsibility than I think he would have a couple months ago.
What do you think, Steve?
Well, I just one thing about your caller's comment that there haven't been a lot of people connecting this. I must have seen 1,000 people making that connection on Twitter. So at least in one realm, there is that connection being made. I think it is definitely true that for the Assad regime, they're aware that the course of the Syrian civil war has been downgraded as a concern of the United States. They also know that the Russians are prepared to back them up no matter what. So in those circumstances, you know, a regime that wants to get rid of its internal opponents and you know, destroy the last remaining positions of its armed opposition, it's going to feel it has a freer hand.
Well, so, David, this is the thing that confuses me about what we're hearing from the Trump administration about Syria. You hear Nikki Haley, the U.N. ambassador, saying, or the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., I should say, saying, Russia, you know, you're culpable in this and we're not going to tolerate this. But you hear nothing. The rest of the administration will say nothing about using their apparent leverage with Russia to get them to intervene. Why? Do you understand this?
Let me put it this way. I don't quite understand it, but I do in a sense that what is going on is that every administration comes in and usually they take a couple months to figure out their overall orientation. They do policy reviews. They fill all the slots. And as your listeners probably know, many of the top foreign policy positions haven't even been filled yet. So we really don't have a thorough policy in place where when something happens, we know how to respond. And that's China, North Korea, and Syria, and any number of other things. Well, you don't even have an ambassador to many of these places or top officials.
Call here from Carlos in Minneapolis. Hi, Carlos. You've been thinking about Russia as well?
Yes, yes. I just want to briefly qualify myself. I have intimate relationship with individuals on the left and on the right, so I'm not making this statement as a pro or against Trump. Uh-huh. But I think we need to really, as a country, we need to put pressure and run and the Trump administration, because this is where the precedent is critical. This is a very serious issue. I mean, we have at stake possibly deploying Americans that could be possibly killed. This is something that we need to press the White House to really, this is not a Twitter, this is not just a campaign statement. We need some clarity. We need Congress, we need everybody putting pressure on the White House to say, you may not be qualified to be president, but you are, and you got to speed up this process. This
okay.
is how to learn as you go.
So, Steve, I take Carlos's point here. What, you know, essentially he's saying, well, what can you tell the American people about where you stand on some of these big international issues? We don't know that, do we?
Carlos is exactly right. And one of the things about a crisis of this kind early in an administration is that it can force an administration to know, to find out what it thinks. It brings people together, forces them to sit down and talk over what options there are. It puts new issues on the agenda. For example, the Secretary of State is going to Moscow next week. This issue is clearly going to be more prominent than it would have been before the attack of Monday. Similarly, Nikki Haley at the UN is trying to put pressure on the Russians by saying to them, you know, we want you to step back from the Assad regime. We want you to put some pressure on them. But let me point out a pattern here. There is, in the meetings with China this week, an effort to get China to put pressure on North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
In meetings with Russia, there's going to be pressure, an attempt to get them to put pressure on Syria. What's left out of this is the issue of what it is that the United States is going to do besides trying to get other people to solve a problem for us.
Yeah.
And that's where there's a kind of gap in American policy. What is it that's going to be our policy?
If you've just gotten in on the conversation, you hear our guests talking about some of the international hotspots that are suddenly on President Trump's agenda. I mean, obviously, he knew he was going to have to develop an international policy, but we've seen these missiles out of North Korea. We've seen this chemical attack in Syria. And now the president is having a meeting today in Florida with the president of China. So we're taking note of some of these developing incidents and the overall Trump doctrine on international policy, as it, I think I hear our guests saying, it's unclear at the moment, early days, still developing. David Kang is with us. He's director of the USC Center for International Studies. And Steve Sestanovich is with us, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of a new book called Maximalist America in the World, from Truman to Obama. Asking you about some of the international issues that you're curious about, concerned about, and whether overall you see management of international policy, again, with the caveat that this is early, but whether you see the White House managing this deftly, or does it raise some concerns for you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And I'm on Twitter at CarrieMPR, and to the phones to Tom in Minneapolis. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. Your question for our guests.
Yeah, my question is, it just seems like the timing is really off, because Assad really just got, you know, almost a neutral rating from the Trump administration last week. Why would he gas his people and cause an outrage?
Yeah, I mean, David, this is I take Tom's point here. He got somewhat of a free pass from the administration saying there's nothing we can do to dislodge him from power. So then he kind of says, look at me. Look what I can do. Why?
Well, I think what Steve said is right. It's like, you know, he's saying, okay, let's see. Do you really think you can't do anything? I mean, it's almost a direct test of what the U.S. is going to do.
But why does he? I mean, he would be able to act with complete autonomy.
Impunity.
Yeah, right. Which he does anyway. It seems like. But
yes, you know, I think all of these issues, whether it's North Korea or Syria, I mean, they're horrific. And in some ways, the North Korea issue is potentially more dangerous because those missiles eventually, not now. I want to make that clear. They can't hit the United States today, but they're testing ones that might be able to hit us later on. Have real world implications. And all these countries are trying to see what the United States will do about it. And I think Steve's other point is right, which is we can't just sort of say to China and Russia, you take care of it.
Mm. So, David, what do you think President Trump will say to China about North Korea? And what should he say to China about North Korea?
This is my pet peeve, is that for years, we just say, well, China, it's China's problem. They could solve it. And president after president says China has to make North Korea stop. And the thing is, it's directly against China's interest to make North Korea stop. China could put a lot of economic pressure on North Korea, but then they risk collapsing the regime and facing refugees and lose nuclear weapons. So, yes, they could. But they're not going to because they take all the risks of doing that.
Okay, so, here's why I'm confused about that, though. Because doesn't China also risk those very things that you talked about, collapse of the state and refugees and instability, if they don't manage North Korea's ambitions as well?
In some ways, the problem is that both the United States and China, we can make North Korea disappear if we want to start a war, we want to collapse the regime. But we both face the costs of starting a war or the refugees. So we all have ended up, every regime, every administration comes in claiming to be tougher on China, tougher on North Korea, and then they all tend to come back to the same set of options, which are some sanctions, some rhetoric, and some pressure. And so we can talk tough, but I'm not really sure that we can get China to do anything more about it.
Steve, you agree with that?
Not entirely. I mean, there are things that will happen as a result of North Korean advances with its nuclear and missile programs that China will regard as negative and that ought to be an incentive for them to do more to restrain North Korea. Well, we're not sure exactly what the character of that leverage is. But let me give you two examples. You've already gotten an increase in American missile defense systems in East Asia as a result of the North Koreans' advances. And China doesn't like that because they think it actually changes the strategic balance of power, constrains their own strategic nuclear capabilities. And they've protested this. But it's an inevitable consequence of the North Korean program. So in that respect, without starting a war, the United States takes steps that are disadvantageous for China. And what's interesting to me is how little pressure the Chinese seem to have put on North Korea. It's not clear to me, and David is an expert on this, so I defer to him. It's not clear to me what kind of effort they make behind the scenes. I think it's not clear really to American policymakers. Are they not trying? Are they indifferent to the consequences? This is the kind of debate that you get around policy tables in Washington.
David, what would you say?
You know, nobody's really sure how much pressure China's putting on. Just about a week ago, China declared that they were stopping coal imports from North Korea as part of their compliance with the UN sanctions. But if you actually add up the numbers, they still have room, even under UN sanctions, to import a couple million more tons of coal. So it's not clear what's actually going on with China. But that's the larger point, I think, is still that in general, China doesn't see pressure as having any impact on North Korea, having a positive impact. And so that's not the kind of policy that they're going to pursue. And I think what we're going to see in Mar-a-Lago here is Trump trying to get China to do something, China probably trying to say no, and us essentially being back where we were without a lot of progress.
David, what does North Korea want?
This is the big question. If you think that they're defensive, then these missiles are to deter the United States. After all, we did say all options are on the table, including preemptive strikes. Now, we're not going to do it, but we claim to North Korea, and they take it seriously, right? So are they defensive, or are they actually offensive, which most of us tend to believe?
And so it's it's deterrence to the United States.
Absolutely.
That's what this posturing is.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. In fact, here's one of the reasons that nothing really changes. It's incredibly stable on the regime, on the peninsula. Deterrence works. We don't start a war or put too much pressure on North Korea because they can take out Seoul already with their missiles. They can hit Tokyo already with their missiles. So we don't start a war. We're deterred from it. They're deterred because they know that there will be no negotiated solution to a second Korean War. And so deterrence works. It's not pretty, but it works.
So this is interesting because you're essentially saying that North Korea is as invested in the stability on the peninsula as China, the United States, and South Korea are.
Yes.
Even though they look like the loose cannon in that equation.
It is much, much more stable than we think.
Huh.
Everybody knows how to play this game. This is a game we know. And that's one reason everybody essentially ends up doing the same thing. Because nobody knows what happens if you knock over North Korea one way or the other. But deterrence is pretty stable. Name-calling, chest-thumping, fist-waving.
Steve, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, let me just add one thing to this. In the campaign, Trump got a lot of attention for saying, you know, he thought it might be a good idea for South Korea and Japan to get nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And everybody said, oh, my God, this is, you know, really casting aside decades of American policy. And that's surely true because it's been an American goal to keep the nonproliferation regime in place. Like what I said earlier, that would be a result that would be very upsetting to China. And the question is David right that actually they don't think that's going to happen, they're not too worried about it, or is it more unstable than it seems? If you ended up with the beginnings of reignited nuclear proliferation in East Asia, an arms race, and much more fearful governments is about their security, no matter what experts tell them about how deterrence is stable, then is there more room for mistakes, more pressure on governments to do something, more of a sense that North Korea is actually destabilizing the region? And I don't know the answer to that, but because it does depend on what you think, how you think the Chinese read it. But Trump long ago put his finger on something kind of worrying to governments in the region.
Steve Sestanovich and David Kang with us as we talk about the international issues that confront the Trump administration as President Trump meets with the premier, the president of China, at Mar-a-Lago in Florida today. A question off of Twitter here, David. A listener asks, hey, how come no one is talking about the advanced persistent threat that China poses electronically? Is he talking about hacking or?
Probably cyber. A lot of people are talking about it. It's one of the most, one of the biggest issues, again, in security is how competition has moved into cyber. And of course, there's all the questions about, for example, the North Korean hack of Sony or this mm-hmm. suspected North Korean hack of Sony and China and Russian hacking. And so this is a forefront. And I have to say, I don't know that much about it other than it's a big concern. I don't know if Steve does.
Steve?
Well, you know, there's not a bigger issue in discussion of Russia these days than the, interference in the election last year, the hacking of the Democratic National Committee. And that was a kind of demonstration of how governments can interfere in each other's internal affairs in a way that people hadn't been prepared for. Goes beyond the Sony hack, for example, which was pretty scary to a lot of people, but it didn't involve serious political consequences. The reason the national security bureaucracy is in an uproar and the Congress is in an uproar and the media are in an uproar about Russia is that there's a lot of mystery, not just about what exactly the Russians were trying to do, but how they were connected to the Trump campaign mm-hmm. in trying to do that. That has, until Syria drove it off the front pages,
right.
That was the big issue of foreign policy discussion and of Russian-American relations. We'll
Steve,
see whether it continues to be.
I was going to say, as you know, it's back on the front page because Devin Nunes has stepped out of running the Russia probe through the House Intelligence Committee.
Yep.
Does that matter? do you think?
Well, it certainly is a sign that he made a big mistake, because he wouldn't have had made a mistake last week in the way he handled some of the information that he got. Obviously antagonized a lot of people in his own party in Congress, and he probably discovered that it was just going to be impossible to continue his role in the investigation and to make the investigation credible. So a good step for him, really. Now we'll see whether the Congress is able, and particularly the House Intelligence Committee, which is what he was the chairman of, will be able to go forward with an investigation that isn't so hampered by partisan sniping.
David in St. Paul called to say, in general, President Trump's foreign policies have already been full of blunders. A Navy SEAL was killed in Yemen. 200 civilians were killed in U.S. airstrikes in Mosul. And there isn't a clear policy or strategy here. A call from Cole in Minneapolis. Hi, Cole.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You're actually pivoting to exactly what I was calling about. Looking at the atrocity in Syria with the nerve gas attack, and then comparing that to, an atrocious event with the bombing in Iraq. I'm curious if your guests would sort of contrast how they see the reaction of the president to the new reaction to from the president to this action in Syria, and then an atrocity that we very well may be responsible for,
right.
Whether or not that's if we're ramping up our military stance as a result of the new administration or not. So I'll take my answer off the air.
David, would you weigh in on that first?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're watching is that President Trump is really being forced, as Steve said, to clarify what he really thinks, because he really didn't want to be involved that much around the world. He wanted to pull back. And these issues are dragging him back in, and he's going to have to figure out how to draw the line on where he gets involved or where the United States gets involved.
I'm a little confused, Steve, about the all the money being invested in building up the military with a foreign policy that looked like, as David just said, it was going to be more about withdrawing than asserting.
Yeah, I disagree a little bit about withdrawing as the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a kind of deeper incoherence in the Trump policy, because it involves both a desire to push people around more and take less responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two strains at war with each other. What I call the sort of kick-ass confrontational style. You know,
yeah.
That's kind of the president as the bully, bossing people around, telling other countries what to do, and we're out of here, we're doing less, other people have been cheating us. And I think it's important to see that this is a new style of pullback from international responsibilities. George McGovern's old slogan, come home, America,
mm-hmm.
This isn't that. It's a much more sort of lead with your chin style of withdrawal.
You know, we're going to get a look at the latest news. And when we come back and continue with our guests, David Kang and Steve Sestanovich, I want to develop something that Steve just suggested here, which is a foreign policy that seems to operate, out of grievance. I mean, when President Trump and then candidate Trump talked about how America would be in the world, there was often this sense of we're being cheated, we need to assert ourselves, we've been kicked around for a long time. So I'm going to ask our guests about that sense of grievance. And if you have a question or some insight on that, you're welcome into the conversation as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'll get to more of the questions here off of Twitter. You can reach me at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Look at the latest news, then right back to our conversation to Mike Moen now. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Kerri. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee announced this morning he is temporarily stepping aside from the panel's probe into Russian meddling in last year's presidential election. The decision by Congressman Devin Nunes comes amid partisan turmoil on the committee. Democrats have alleged that Nunes, who was on President Trump's transition team, is too close to the White House and cannot lead an impartial inquiry. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he supports the decision. The committee is investigating allegations that Nunes may have made unauthorized disclosures of classified information. Votes are expected today in the Senate battle over President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. 44 Democrats and independents will try to block Neil Gorsuch by denying Republicans the 60 votes needed to move forward. Republicans intend to respond by changing Senate rules to remove a 60-vote filibuster requirement for Supreme Court nominees. The Syrian foreign minister is categorically denying his government used chemical weapons in an attack this week. The attack killed more than 80 people and sickened dozens more, many of whom are being treated across the border in Turkey. The Trump administration and others have said the attack was carried out by government forces in Syria. And U.S. stocks are wavering this morning after a sharp drop late in the previous day. Energy companies are rising with the price of oil, and retailers are up after a series of strong sales reports. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's mostly sunny and 42 degrees. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:37.
I want to make sure you know about an event that I am really excited about. Princeton theologian Eddie Glaude is going to be with me at the Fitzgerald Theater on May 16th. Our topic, what it means to be an American of color. You can buy your tickets at the Fitzgerald website, or you can go to the thread, nprnews.org/thread. That is May 16th at the Fitz with Eddie Glaude. I promise you a dynamic and interactive conversation.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, an update on the upcoming trial of the officer charged in the traffic stop death last year of Philando Castile. You'll also hear about a legal dispute in Burnsville over a mobile home park and why it could have implications elsewhere in Minnesota. You'll also hear an update on all the millions of unexploded bombs and ordnance still littering the countryside in Laos. Tune in at 11.
Support comes from Visit Brainerd. Minnesota's playground lies in the heart of central Minnesota's Lake Country, where you can immerse yourself in birding, hiking, biking, fishing, and more. Perfect for weekend wandering or a week-long vacation. Visit Brainerd.com.
It is my night behind the mic for Indivisible, our national call-in show about the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Tonight, I am talking about the idea and ideal of the American dream. And we're not just talking economics. We're talking philosophy tonight as well. That's at 7 o'clock. Phone lines will open. Love to hear from you wherever you are in the country, but, of course, in our region as well. That's at 7 o'clock tonight, Indivisible. Back to the conversation now. David Kang and Steve Sestanovich with us. And let me grab a call that I think goes to kind of where I wanted to advance the discussion, to Mark in Mound. Hi, Mark. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate your efforts through this. I would assert that it's very interesting that his put-upon worldview policy that we need to hunker down, take care of ourselves, is not at all dissimilar to his assertion to his core constituency that you are put upon, you've been economically ravaged by the past administration, and it's subsequently he's got himself into an interesting corner because as the world draws him out into a larger theater of expectation, similarly so, our economy is going forward in many regards without him, i.e. the fact that Ford has been outclassed by Tesla, a vertically integrated company, whereas Ford is a flat, build the cars, do the motors thing. Follow my logic?
Yeah.
That's my thought.
Yeah, Mark, that's interesting. David, you first on that.
Yeah, no, I think that this is very much part of his appeal, certainly to the American electorate. And Steve's point of like the chin first is absolutely right. What I find, again, is that the world is moving on without him. And one of the things that you're certainly seeing, at least in Asia, is that these countries are going to continue to trade with each other and are working with each other. And in some ways, I'm sort of surprised we're 40 minutes in and we haven't talked about China at all. It's the biggest country in the world.
Wait a minute. We did talk about China with North Korea, but you're right. In general,
right.
We didn't.
Like the meeting that's going on between these two massive countries. And this is the problem of being a president, is these other things take precedence over the fact that China China is not going away. It is a billion people, and we have to live with it. We got to figure out a way to live with it. And that's the perfect example of what foreign policy is like.
Yeah, Steve, I think our caller was also kind of channeling where I wanted to go with this, which is the president and this and these policies, and maybe domestic as well, of kind of grievance. We have scores to settle. That seems a little more dangerous when you're on the foreign stage than it does when you're in domestic policy arena.
Well, it can be dangerous, particularly if you kind of misunderstand your own situation. That is, don't understand what your own strengths and weaknesses are. You're absolutely right that Trump campaigned on the idea of American weakness, of other countries cheating us, not paying enough for alliances, getting the better of us on trade deals and so forth, not respecting us. The theme of Obama's weakness and lack of respect, even when polls showed the opposite globally, that was central to the Trump campaign.
Right.
And it's very relevant to the case of China. David wants us to talk about that, and I'm happy to. There's no doubt that the single country to which Trump kind of promised a new relationship, a more contentious one where we wouldn't be taken advantage of, was China. China is the source of all of this economic difficulty that he described. But of course, if you're going to take on China and you want to have an advantageous bargaining relationship, you've got to have people with you. And one of the things that the president did right out of the box after his inauguration was put aside the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which was a kind of trading alliance, also shadow alliance, with a dozen other countries, that gave the United States some extra weight in dealing with China. But because Trump is so focused on all trade deals being bad, mm-hmm. on all countries trying to take advantage of us, he doesn't actually see the advantages, or didn't, and is now maybe having to adjust, of close relations with American allies who can help us. And that's something that I think is still on a learning curve about.
So, David, outside of the TPP, what can the president really do about changing the terms of trade with China?
I think that's one of the realizations that he's coming to, is that a lot of the things that you can promise are a lot different in reality, and that particularly every president comes in saying we're going to be tougher on China and they're taking advantage of us. Hmm. And almost every president begins to back off a little bit when they realize there's not that much leverage. So there's certain things you can do about trade and, but he's accusing China of manipulating its currency when everybody agrees they haven't done that in years. So he's aiming at the wrong place for China and where they want to go.
To the phones to Elliot in the Twin Cities. Hi, Elliot. Your question for our guests.
Yeah, I wanted to see how the guests thought about this administration's approach to foreign engagement as compared to historically how the country has engaged in world affairs. For instance, the First World War, the Second World War, Korean conflict, Vietnam.
Okay. It's a lot of territory you're covering there.
You can make it smaller if you want. But I'm just curious which direction this administration appears to be taking compared to those historical approaches.
Okay. Steve?
Well, I want to thank the caller for giving me an opportunity to plug my book, because the argument I make in my book Maximalist is that our strategy in the world has actually been kind of cyclical. We've tended to think, we've got to solve a problem in a big way, get very involved, throw a lot of resources at it. Then when that doesn't go too well, involving some of the overcommitments and, the stalemated wars in Korea and Vietnam and Iraq, then there's a kind of down cycle where we try to pull back, save resources, put burdens onto allies, and that is a kind of cyclical alternation that you've seen really for 70 years, I would argue. But what is always interesting is that at each point in the kind of in the down cycle, we then have a debate about what we should do next. And Trump represents a pretty interesting evolution of that debate. As I suggested earlier, he sort of argued we should both be doing more and less. We should push people around and not take responsibility for too much in the world. And that, I think, is a strategy that's going to have to be refined. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the way that he's articulated it, and he's going to have to get people around him who can help him turn that into something more viable. Other presidents have done that. You know, they get help. They get advisors, secretaries of state and defense, who can lead them to a more operational and sustainable, workable policy. Trump isn't there yet.
Yeah, David, this kind of goes to a question that I had, which is whether you think the Trump White House has the focus and the strategy and the knowledge to develop this coherent and more consistent foreign policy? Or is what we're seeing now probably the way it's going to go?
I don't think it's the way it's going to go. I certainly hope not, because, again, he has only begun to fill many of those positions. And hopefully that as these as his advisors, as the secretaries and the undersecretaries begin to fill, as the ambassadors fill the positions, they'll formulate the policy. What I think is interesting about the China meeting today is that, from what I understand, is they still haven't decided how confrontational they want to be, what actually they want to press on and what they don't want to press on. And so we're all waiting to see what actually happens.
So how unusual is that, that this meeting is now within hours and they're not quite sure what they're leading with?
That is unusual. I mean, this is one of the things where you look at Trump and sometimes question the decisions to be made, because if you don't have the policy ready to go and the review is being finished in real time,
right,
having a major meeting between the two largest countries in the world is potentially a little bit risky.
You know, what's interesting to me, David, was that the Chinese president pressed for an early summit.
Yes, he did.
So what's the strategy of that?
I think the Chinese, look, Xi Jinping knows what he wants to do. He has a very clear policy for his country. It's more authoritarianism. It's back to the communist era. But he knows what he wants to do, and he knows what he wants to do in the region, and he wants a good relationship with America. And he knows, so having an early meeting for him is great because he gets to take the advantage. And I think he's coming with a lot of superficial wins. I mean, if I was him, I'd bribe him with, you know, here you can have this voluntary export restraint and this jobs, make Trump look superficially good, and then get Trump to roll over on some bigger things.
Which are?
One China policy, North Korea, South China Seas. There's a lot of Taiwan. There's a lot of things that really matter to Xi Jinping that it's not clear whether Trump's administration has really thought through how they want to deal with it.
Steve, how about that? Rolling over on the big things.
I'm not saying he will. You know, I just say that's Trump's his strategy.
Right.
My impression is that a lot of foreign leaders who have met with Trump so far have come to the conclusion, just as David says, that you've got to sort of have the mood music of the meeting be Trump made it a success. He got something. And so there's an emphasis on showing some little bit of tribute, some concession that is made to the great new American president, while basically trying to get your own way. And that I think was sort of the approach that the British Prime Minister took, that Chancellor Merkel of Germany took, that the Prime Minister Abe of Japan took. You know, for example, come with some of your own business executives and say that you're going to invest in American factories, something of that sort. The Chinese they've looked at this script and obviously seem to see some advantages for themselves. So one question will be, what does the Chinese president do along those lines in order to get, as David says, his own core interests protected.
What I find so interesting about what you two are saying on that, and I know strategy, of course, takes in the psychological profiles of presidents. I know that's probably not unusual. But the way that you both are talking about these countries playing to the swagger and the bluster of a president like Donald Trump is super smart. And, you know, in some ways, it risks some of these other leaders looking, for the time being, you know, somewhat subservient, I guess. But they're making the long play to get what they want.
Well, you know what they're doing is they're kind of reading Trump as a celebrity.
Yeah.
And not really as a negotiator. Their view is, this is somebody who's kind of interested in the reality TV message, the you know, the choreography of it, to sort of have it look good.
Yeah, the promo that comes out of the meeting,
right? More interested in that than in the substance. You know, Trump has proclaimed himself to be a master negotiator, but I think what a lot of these governments are saying is, you know, we can probably do better at negotiating than this guy, because he's not really interested in the outcome. He's interested, particularly since he's had a rocky couple of months in office, he's interested in looking as though he's more on top of his job. And we can help him do that if he will serve our long-term agenda.
David, yes?
Yes, completely.
Huh. On Twitter, Brian says about the grievance policy. He says, grievance equals lack of understanding of benefits from investment in U.S.-led liberal global economic order obsession, with individual data points showing the U.S. burden without the appreciation of the benefits of stability. Can I ask you both one last question here about Bannon, Steve Bannon's removal from the National Security Council? Steve, does that say anything to you about what may be happening behind the scenes around foreign policy in the administration?
Well, it tells you there's a lot of jockeying for influence. What it doesn't tell you is whether influence depends on being part of a particular committee meeting or whether it's got more to do with whispering in the president's ear after hours. And Steve Bannon's membership on this, what was called the Principals Committee of the NSC, made some people think that he was being given a formal role, and that would be the heart of his impact in government and would be able to sway policy. That may be right, and so having him off that committee may be important, but it may be that he's got a broader hold on the president's thinking that comes more from their personal interaction, from the ability to sort of shape the president's instincts and orientation. And if that's the case, then this is not big news. Bannon will still have a lot of opportunities to point the president in one direction or the other.
Steve, I'm really grateful for the insight on all the topics we covered today. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
David, a thought on Bannon and what this may mean or not?
Yeah, no, I mean, I basically see it the same way, in that, you know, I think Bannon and Trump both are much more focused on the domestic politics and the domestic arguments or the issues, and that foreign policy was always secondary. I don't know how to read him being jockeyed off, but my sense is that in general, the Trump administration is still trying to find its sea legs, so to speak, its actual approach to foreign policy, and I don't think we're actually there yet.
Okay, so Steve got to plug his book, and I mentioned yours, China Rising, but maybe you have a newer book that you want to plug. Please do.
I do have a new book.
Excellent.
It's coming out. It's called American Grand Strategy in East Asia in the 21st Century.
Perfect. Perfect for this conversation. And thank you
so much.
Makes
a good Christmas gift.
I really feel like we benefit from your insight and knowledge. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
David Kang with us, director of the USC Center for International Studies, and Steve Sestanovich, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And yes, they both have books. If you missed much of this conversation, you can find it on the podcast. I'm telling you, they gave us some real insight on global events, and we're hearing a lot about that at the moment.